I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Incoming, the presidential candidates, most of them anyway, have now landed. They're on the ground just north of us in New Hampshire after Iowa's caucusgoers anointed Democrat Barack Obama and Republican Mike Huckabee as their presidential choices. Obama landed in Portsmouth, New Hampshire at about 9 Eastern time this morning.
In 4 days, you can say that we're choosing hope over fear. Unity over division. And sending a powerful message that change is coming to Washington and change is coming to America in 4 days' time.
John Edwards, second in Iowa, and Hillary Clinton, who finished a close third, also touched down in New Hampshire early today. Speaking in Manchester, John Edwards told voters he's the candidate best equipped to wage a populist campaign and urged them to reject the results from Iowa. Well, they may be. A new poll out today shows Senators Hillary Clinton and Republican John McCain leading in the Granite State. The Reuters C-SPAN Zogby poll was taken before the Iowa caucuses, but it shows Clinton leading Obama 32% to 26% in New Hampshire, McCain ahead of Mitt Romney 34% to 30% on the Republican side. So where are we today? Richard Wolff is senior White House correspondent for Newsweek. He's in New Hampshire with the Obama campaign. Richard, we're going to start with you. With Obama, his campaign staff must be ecstatic, but I'm sure not taking anything for granted.
Oh, they're very happy that this has played out as they'd hoped, as they'd planned. And, in defiance of what a lot of the pundits and the seasoned political operatives thought that they wouldn't deliver on. So, yeah, they're very happy. They think they're well-placed in New Hampshire. The polls have closed considerably over the last month or two. That gap has narrowed. And they think they're going to get a bounce out of Iowa, which will really put them over the top when it comes to New Hampshire.
And explain, Richard, because if there is a bounce from Iowa, there's less time for that arc of the bounce to come down this year before New Hampshire, because everything's so close.
That's right. You know, often we've focused on the early start to this primary season coming so soon in the new year, but actually what's more significant is the compression, the fact that where, for instance, there used to be 3 or 4 weeks between Iowa and New Hampshire, now we have all of 5 days, and two of those are the weekends. So there's no time for candidates, campaigns to retool, get a new message out, and also undermine their opponents to try and flatten the bounce.
No. Well, that's Richard Wolff, Newsweek in New Hampshire with the Barack Obama campaign. We're also joined by Dante Scala. He's a professor of political science at the University of New Hampshire. He's author of one of our favorite books, Stormy Weather, The New Hampshire Primary and Presidential Politics. Dante, you know that historically a win in Iowa doesn't mean a win in New Hampshire. Remind us.
For certain. New Hampshire has a mixed record when it comes to taking in Iowa's results, especially on the Republican side. We've seen time and again New Hampshire Republicans reject the candidate whom Iowa puts forward. With the Democrats, though, recently at least, we've seen Al Gore and John Kerry win Iowa, then go on to win here in New Hampshire.
Well, but there have been so many times, I'm just going to run through some. There was Gary Hart in 84 and Bob Dole in 88 and Pat Buchanan in 96, John McCain in 2000. I mean, you know, there have been times when, as you've said, there's been a rejection. Is this time, in your mind, different just because Iowa, did Iowa feel different to you this time around, Dante, as a scholar? I mean, record turnouts, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, I think the key difference is that Iowa, to me, seemed a little more like a primary. I mean, with a couple hundred thousand people turning out to vote. I mean, up here in New Hampshire, we're talking about a turnout of 500,000 people next Tuesday, and it's supposed to be a sunny, clear day in New Hampshire. A lot of undeclared or so-called independent voters are going to be out at the polls on Tuesday, and that could throw off a lot of people's turnout operation. Well, you know, that's got to be Hillary Clinton's biggest worry right now.
Well, Richard, let's talk about that, because exit polls are showing that Barack Obama's support in Iowa did come from young women, from first-time caucus goers, from independents, from Republicans who crossed over. You know, what's he doing there in New Hampshire to ensure that same kind of turnout?
Well, organization, campaign offices, volunteers on the ground, you know, they have a model here, and the model works in a much tougher situation where you have to really really encourage people to take out a lot of time in their day to caucus. Much easier to vote in New Hampshire, but it's the same model, and they have a lot of field organizers who organize at the local level, recruiting neighbor to neighbor contact, knocking on doors, getting voters' details, cards. There's an awful lot of really sort of micro-targeted, detailed work. Now, of course, it hasn't been as intense as it was in Iowa, but it's still the case that the Obama folks started this early. They've been building this out for some time, and now they know what works and what doesn't work and how to be really effective in turning people out to vote.
Well, and Dante, we've been hearing that the Obama campaign in particular has some unique approaches, forming book clubs, and people read his book in the book club, and basketball leagues where people play basketball, or lawyers for Obama, really micro-targeting. Are you seeing things that are different this time around in New Hampshire?
I mean, certainly one thing that is, yeah, certainly the micro-targeting that we saw really 4 years ago is, I guess, intensified. It's striking to me how long these campaigns have been at it. I mean, really, Clinton and Obama have been in this state for almost a year now. So they've all had all sorts of time to build up kind of grassroots networks and so forth. So unlike the Republican side, where the organizations are a bit uneven, what's striking to me is how you have really two organizations that are supreme. And Edwards' organization, although it's probably behind the other two, is no slouch. So it's really finely tuned organizations, finally ready to go at it over the next several days.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about Hillary Clinton. Of course, she came in third, sort of neck and neck with John Edwards, but he can claim that he beat her in second place. And we saw the pictures, Richard, this morning in the New York Times. I don't know if you've seen them yet and elsewhere. You know, this was a different image, a softer face, someone who, in one picture, she almost appears to be crying as she leaves the podium last night. In fact, Richard, is there some thinking that this might, that her loss in Iowa might be to Hillary Clinton's benefit?
You know, if you were in a campaign and you offered them the chance to get sympathy for losing or to look like a winner, I think 99.9% of campaigns would say, I'll take the win. Look, her campaign was premised on strength, inevitability, electability. Those have all been shaken to their foundation. She now has to retool in a very compressed amount of time. And if the Clinton campaign had not already retooled several times, tried different messages, different slogans, maybe you could have more confidence in their ability to turn this around quickly. But the truth is that a lot of journalists have picked this up. They've had so many slogans, so many different images. Her voice, the tone of her voice even changed in the last couple of weeks in Iowa. There's a certain amount of, there's a constancy or an inconstancy problem that the Clinton campaign now faces as they try something really quite different to stop Barack Obama and halt his momentum.
You mentioned Clinton's tone of voice having changed in the couple of last weeks. According to the Associated Press, Dante, it's changed again today. She did just meet with voters in Nashua, New Hampshire, and as she landed and met with some of her supporters, apparently had a new urgency in her voice, asked people to consider, learn everything they could about her candidacy, asked who would be the best president based not on a leap of faith, but on the kind of changes that a candidate has already produced, of course, pointing to her own experience. But the voters, Dante, apparently asked her about her electability and how she could withstand negative information that circulated about her on the Internet. This is according to the Associated Press in this meeting between Clinton and some of her supporters, New Hampshire voters. Your sense of what, how Hillary Clinton has to sort of recalibrate as she comes into New Hampshire?
I mean, the real difficulty is, perceptions of inevitability are one thing, but, of course, electability boils down to a simple thing when caucuses and primaries start. Who's won and who's lost? And winners win and losers go home. That's the difficulty for Clinton right now. And it's very difficult to retool on the fly and come up with a different message. What she's got to hope is that Obama wilts somewhat under the spotlight of becoming the front runner, and that Clinton can succeed in counterpunching. We're really going to see the mettle of her campaign here. I mean, there have been times, George Bush back in 1988, Ronald Reagan back in 1980, who suffered big losses in Iowa but then rebounded in New Hampshire. We're about to find out in 5 days whether Clinton belongs to that class of remarkable candidates or whether she's going to be an also-ran.
Well, and another one you might add to the list, I don't know, is her own husband. He was second to the late Massachusetts Senator Paul Tsongas in New Hampshire in 1992, but he portrayed himself then as the comeback kid.
Absolutely. And we're going to see, I mean, you know, the Hillary Clinton campaign made some noises yesterday about the fact that Bill Clinton had not won a primary in 1992 until Georgia. But the difficulty for Clinton is the road doesn't get easier from New Hampshire. We go to places like South Carolina, where there's a very large African-American population of Democrats that's watching with earnest to see whether Obama is for real. And they define for real is, can he win in white America? And it's hard to get any whiter than Iowa and New Hampshire.
Well, we want to talk more about that, but turn to the Republicans just to have done that for a couple of minutes before we take a break, and then, of course, expand there because the GOP winner in Iowa, Mike Huckabee, is also coming to New Hampshire later today. Last night, he called his results a new day in politics. Let's listen.
A new day is needed in American politics, just like a new day is needed in American government. And tonight, it starts here in Iowa, but it doesn't end here. It goes all the way through the other states and ends at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue 1 year from now.
Richard Wolff, Mike Huckabee beat Mitt Romney by nearly 10 percentage points. Does his Christian conservative message resonate in New Hampshire? Or, as Rich Lowry, who's the very conservative editor of the National Review, said, does the party putting forth Huckabee mean that the Republicans are creating Huckicide, which was, you know, his word? What's going to happen as he goes forward?
Well, Republican voters do look very different in New Hampshire from the ones in Iowa. This is really what Huckabee has done has really delivered a significant blow to Mitt Romney, and that's opened up in many ways the dream scenario for John McCain to come back to his old stomping ground where he won so heavily in 2000, take on Mitt Romney here, finish him off. Is the hope of the McCain campaign, and really appeal to voters both on national security, but also to fiscal conservatives in New Hampshire. So this isn't really Huckabee territory. This has now turned into a Romney-McCain battle where Romney really has to show that he has some leverage as a former Massachusetts governor.
That's Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek in New Hampshire. We're also talking to Dante Scala, professor of political science at the University of New Hampshire. As the focus shifts to New Hampshire after Iowa, Iowa already sort of fading in the rearview mirror. We're going to do more looking at what's happening on the ground in New Hampshire when we come back. Gentlemen, stay with us. Back in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're talking what else? Presidential politics, which have moved on to New Hampshire today in advance of Tuesday's primary. It's coming up so quick. We've been speaking with Richard Wolff of Newsweek magazine. He was in Iowa. He's now in New Hampshire with the Barack Obama campaign. And political scientist and author Dante Scala of the University of New Hampshire is with us as well. And Richard, you were just saying that Iowa was about Mike Huckabee defeating Mitt Romney. The contest in New Hampshire is really Mitt Romney versus John McCain, at least in the front runners. Mitt Romney arrived in Portsmouth, New Hampshire before dawn today. Let's listen to what he said.
I let one guy slip by me. Hats off to him. He did a nice job. We're not gonna let that happen here in New Hampshire or anywhere else.
That's Mitt Romney sounding a little hoarse, but he has reason to. He was speaking in Portsmouth at about 3:30 this morning. Dante Scala, there at the University of New Hampshire, characterize his campaign. Does another one from history come to mind for you? I mean, what would you say Mitt Romney has to do?
Mitt Romney has to find a way to stop John McCain. For the 2 weeks prior to the Iowa caucuses, there was only one Republican with real momentum in this state, and that was John McCain. Mitt Romney was doing fine, kind of holding in place and so forth, but McCain has succeeded in becoming the candidate of Republican moderates and Republican-leaning independents supplanting Rudy Giuliani. And so now the difficulty is that now that he's gotten a negative bounce out of Iowa, can Romney find a way to come back with McCain on his left and Huckabee on his right? Huckabee won't win here, but he can pull social conservative voters to his side who might otherwise go to Romney.
And Richard, I want to ask you what you think about the tact that Mitt Romney have been taking. He's been criticized by other Republicans who seem to have ganged up on him on his attack ads. Here's an ad that from Romney that features New Hampshire residents on why John McCain should not be president. Let's listen.
I'm Mitt Romney, and I approve this message.
I believe John McCain's war record is outstanding.
He's a true patriot and has served his country long and well.
However, his record in the U.S. Senate leaves a lot to be desired.
John McCain has been one of those Republicans that have been wrong on tax cuts.
Opposing tax cuts.
Richard Wolff, the Arizona Republic newspaper in McCain's home state, criticized the ad, saying Romney had to resort to people on the street because he couldn't quote any newspaper endorsements as John McCain can. Your thoughts?
Well, I think there's a pretty way for Mitt Romney to deal with a situation. He's got to make these negative contrasts. He's got to go out and do these attack ads. Although, frankly, they're fairly gentle attack ads. Where, you know, in the grand scale of American politics, this is pretty mild stuff. And it's very effective as a rebuff for the McCain folks who don't have, even at this stage, a huge amount of resources to question Romney's character, which is what they're doing. That itself is an attack in one way or another.
Finish your thought.
This is what you would expect in a close, very fluid race. Romney attacking McCain on taxes is a direct appeal to those fiscal conservatives who may like McCain's rhetoric on things like pork barrel spending, but there are significant doubts about McCain's relationship to the base when it comes to things like campaign finance, his ability, his readiness to work with Democrats. I mean, there's a lot of resentment about how McCain has operated in Washington through the Bush years.
Dante Scala, I'm going to ask you to comment on a McCain ad. He's running one featuring Boston Red Sox pitcher Curt Schilling, he of the bloody sock from a World Series a while back for our listeners nationally. He's a New England, favorite. Here he is endorsing McCain.
We're living in a complex and dangerous world that requires a leader who embodies character, judgment, and experience.
Curt Schilling on John McCain.
John McCain is that man. John has a backbone of steel. He's a man of principle who sticks to his guns.
John McCain also running an ad in New Hampshire reminding voters that he won the state in 2000 and asking them to help him again. Dante Scala, how do you see this matchup between Mitt Romney and John McCain? And do you see that as the – I make sure I don't put words in your mouth. Do you see that as the primary matchup for the Republicans in New Hampshire?
Yeah, certainly that is the matchup. I mean, this really is, if not Mitt Romney's last stand, his next to last stand. He'll go on to Michigan, I imagine. But the difficulty here is how do you take down John McCain, especially because he's been left alone now for 6 months, ever since his national campaign melted down last summer. McCain has had a free ride here. No one's really paid much attention to him. So it's very difficult now to try to tear him down, especially in a state where there are such good feelings for him. It's true that McCain has troubles with the base nationally, but McCain doesn't have a lot of troubles with the New Hampshire base, which is a good deal more moderate than the national base is.
That's Dante Scala of the University of New Hampshire. Gentlemen, Richard Wolff there from Newsweek as well. I just want to say that we've just got an email from one of our listeners, Dewey Vanderhoff, who's in Cody, Wyoming, who says, wait a second, Wyoming is holding its Republican primary tomorrow, Saturday, the statewide Republican caucus, rather, and the Casper Star Tribune endorsed Mitt Romney. So there's more to life than New Hampshire. But perhaps that's more if you're in Wyoming. I mean, Richard, what would you say, I mean, just as we go here, what would you say, how high are the stakes in New Hampshire this upcoming Tuesday and this weekend?
They're very high. I mean, you could say this about any race, but New Hampshire has a lot of symbolic value, even though this primary campaign is very curtailed. It's really about cementing the path as they move forward out of here. for Obama to win both Iowa and New Hampshire would really give him a tremendous amount of momentum, put Hillary Clinton in a very difficult position. Romney faces the same sort of scenario. A loss in both places will raise very big question marks about his survivability. So these are, if not game changers, then game shapers.
And tomorrow night, the debates will be on. The Republicans will see Mike Huckabee, John McCain, Rudy Giuliani, Fred Thompson, Mitt Romney, and Ron Paul. And on the Democrat side, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, John Edwards, and Bill Richardson. So they're right back at it this weekend in New Hampshire. You guys will be there. We'll be joining you soon. Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek. And Dante Scala, professor of political science at the University of New Hampshire, author of Stormy Weather, The New Hampshire Primary and Presidential Politics, a great read. Thank you both, as always.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And we're going to continue after the news. Take a look at news out of Pakistan. Will U.S. Special Forces be on the ground there? We'll have that and the new trend for princess brides, real ones, back in about 8 minutes, here and now. A team from Scotland Yard arrived in Pakistan today to join in the investigation of former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto's assassination. But President Pervez Musharraf, whose government is widely seen as rushing to conclusions about how Bhutto was killed last month, warned that the British investigators will not be allowed to go on a wild goose chase. The nuclear-armed country, thought to be the home of Osama bin Laden, is in turmoil following the assassination and the subsequent postponement of elections from January to February. Well, according to our next guest, U.S. interactions with Pakistan may be about to shift profoundly in that the U.S. military's special forces have been given permission to vastly expand their presence in Pakistan, to operate more or less unilaterally there to capture terrorists. Joining us is military analyst William Arkin, who writes the national security blog Early Warning for The Washington Post. Bill, you broke this story last week on your blog. To understand the impact of the new rules, let's start by understanding the old rules. Have there been U.S. Special Forces in Pakistan?
Well, there were after 9/11, which is to say that once the United States decided to go to war to depose the Taliban and try to defeat al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, a lot of arm twisting was used to put pressure upon Pakistan to provide bases, which were essentially stepping stones into a fairly isolated place. And so for a period of about 6 months, the U.S. military operated a couple of air bases inside Pakistan, as well as a series of logistical hubs that were used to resupply U.S. forces. That is, until U.S. forces captured Bagram Air Base north of Kabul and established their own operating base. And then quietly as they had entered Pakistan, the U.S. military left.
So on your timeline, U.S. troops have moved into Afghanistan, and for years the CIA was, you know, quote-unquote responsible for Pakistan. Now these new rules say that special forces are going to, you know, be going into Pakistan. Tell us more about what the new agreement says and who negotiated it.
Well, you have to go back to a sort of very important public slap in the face that the Bush administration gave to Pakistan in late 2006. And that was in a national intelligence estimate which came out about the threat from al-Qaeda and the situation in Pakistan. The U.S. government explicitly stated for the first time that Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri and other al-Qaeda leaders lived in Pakistan. Before then, the U.S. had kind of obscured that point and said we didn't know where he was, etc. But this sea change for the U.S. was a sea change in more than one way. Not only was it saying to Musharraf and the Pakistani government, hey, you know what, we've given you all this leeway and you haven't really defeated al-Qaeda. In fact, the situation is worse than ever. But also at the same time, it was stating that we are not going to continue to follow our policy of deferring completely to you, Musharraf. We're now going to start thinking about what's in American national interests. And I believe that that sea change was what started the State Department's track towards democracy and pushing Musharraf to accept Bhutto's return. It was what began a process of reevaluating the military strategy vis-a-vis Pakistan, and it was the beginning of a reevaluation of our strategy in Afghanistan, which ultimately has led to a realization that there's a sanctuary, and that sanctuary in Pakistan is where the Taliban and Al-Qaeda withdraw to in order to be safe from, but then to threaten U.S. forces in Afghanistan.
So now we have this new agreement that, as you said, started to be forged before Bhutto was killed, this new agreement that will allow special forces to be on the ground in Pakistan operating unilaterally. What does that mean?
Well, it's unclear what the agreement means now, and it isn't clear either whether or not that assassin's bullet didn't, in fact, put a hole in this agreement. But with Secretary Gates coming in after the 2006 elections, replacing Rumsfeld, with a complete command change at the top of the American military, what happened was there was also a change in policy and strategy. And this sea change brought in a new man as the head of the U.S. Special Operations Command, an Admiral Eric Olson. And when he came into office in May of last year, one of the things that he put as his priority was finding a way of increasing the level of military activity inside Pakistan itself. And that began a series of very sensitive negotiations with the Pakistani military and the Pakistani government, not only to provide additional American support for Pakistan's own counterterrorism forces, but to open the door for unilateral American military operations on Pakistani soil, which would be unprecedented because even after 9/11, when the U.S. operated on Pakistani soil, it did so with a focus completely on Afghanistan.
Yeah. Bill Arkin, given the unrest and uncertainty in Pakistan and the volatile nature of the country, wouldn't this be absolutely the worst time for U.S. Forces to be on the ground acting unilaterally and perhaps sending a signal to people that the country is about to be taken over by the U.S.? I mean, wouldn't this be the worst time for troops to be there, or do you think it would be a good time for them to be there?
Well, first of all, when you use the word troops, it connotes soldiers walking down the streets and patrols and bases and an observable force. And you have to remember that what's going on here is agreements for which undercover soldiers, if you will, special operations forces, commanders, people who operate in the shadows, are going to be going to Pakistan. So the connotation is it should be a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
But the second thing is, look, Al-Qaeda is headquartered in Pakistan, and most of the international terrorist incidents that we do experience in the West always find their roots back in Pakistan. And Pakistan is the epicenter of global international terrorism today. I don't particularly agree with the strategy that the American government pursues in going after terrorism, but the truth of the matter is that we can't allow a sanctuary in which people who are working against the United States and Western security to operate because of Musharraf's weakness. In fact, I would argue that it is for the precise reason that Musharraf is weak that the United States needs to pursue some kind of a different strategy, because the more attention that Musharraf places on domestic security and on his own preservation of power, the less time and energy is being spent going after the bad guys in Western Pakistan and in the border areas between Afghanistan and Pakistan.
That's military analyst William Arkin. He writes the national security blog Early Warning for The Washington Post. He reported on an agreement reached between the U.S. and Pakistan before the Bhutto assassination to send U.S. special forces to Pakistan. We'll have to see how that unfolds. Bill, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
And a quick look at next week. We'll be in New Hampshire, of course, but also, where are American spies going when they come in from the cold? Maybe your company. We'll take a look at corporate espionage. That's next week. You're listening to Here and Now. Texas Congressman Ron Paul made a respectable showing in last night's Republican caucus in Iowa, coming in fifth place with 10% of the vote ahead of Rudy Giuliani. The 72-year-old Ron Paul is popular with libertarians for opposing the federal income tax and the war in Iraq, for calling for less and more fiscally responsible government. Well, this weekend, Ron Paul will speak at the Liberty Forum in New Hampshire, sponsored by the Free State Project. Now, we first spoke to founders of this group a couple of years ago. They're recruiting libertarians to pick up and move to the Granite State to influence the political process there. So far, thousands have pledged to move, but only a few hundred have done so. Cal Pratt and his wife Karen were among the first back in 2003. Cal, why did you move to New Hampshire?
Because there were two aspects that I appreciated about the state, having been here before the Free State Project voted to make New Hampshire their home. The one is that it is the freest state. The less government intrusion into the lives of individuals, that's a plus. And the second one is I knew there would be other free staters here, so I had a community that was waiting for me.
Well, you're 57 years old, and I'm just wondering, did that make it difficult for you to make a move and get a job, or does the Free State Project help with that?
There's a lot of support. I found work on my own. A lot of people are independently employed, or they're in positions such as IT or finance, where they can basically work any place they can find an internet connection.
Huh. Well, the project's original goal was to have 20,000 people move to New Hampshire. 8,000 have pledged to move. 300 have done so. 200 were already living there, so there's about 500 there. Are you disappointed? Because, you know, with 500, it doesn't seem as if the group's really going to make an impact on this election.
The energy and the talents that the small group of people who have moved here already is out of proportion to their numbers. Huh. And plus, we're not doing this in isolation. We're working with local organizations and supplementing their membership.
Organizations like what? Because we want to be clear, you're not the Libertarian Party. You're libertarians who have formed this project. So what are the organizations you are finding, soulmates in?
Oh, we have Granite State Taxpayers. We have Second Amendment groups. There are constitutional organizations here. Homeschooling organizations, anything that empowers the individual, we pretty much are on board with that, because that's our philosophy, that choices should be made from the bottom up, not from the top down.
Well, and your group made its decision to move to New Hampshire before a guy named Ron Paul was really on anybody's radar. Now he is, very much so. What do you think about him as a candidate?
I think he's excellent, because his message is precisely the message that the vast majority of free staters, in my own case, I can say that about 80% of Dr. Paul's philosophy is my philosophy. So I don't find it very hard to actually have a candidate that I can, in good conscience, vote for.
Yeah, but he's certainly raising more money, setting records, raising money, or his supporters are actually raising record amounts of money, certainly getting a lot of attention. But still, he's considered and not a top-tier candidate at all, at least in the polling. What do you think might happen in New Hampshire?
Well, I'm very interested to see how many people in New Hampshire will end up casting a vote for Dr. Paul, because that will give the Free State Project some indication of how our message would resonate, some of the things we would like to see happen here, some of the ways we would like to see government go back to the local level and work up from there. I'm anxious to see what's going to happen within the next 5 days, for that reason alone.
Do you think he might surprise everybody and get one of the top three, let's say, slots?
I think it's a definite possibility, yes.
Would it be enough if he didn't, though? Is the symbolism enough for you?
Well, it's not just the symbolism. There's a very real chance that Dr. Paul's efforts, along with what we're seeing with Obama and Huckabee, that people are tired of politics of the old school, and they are anxious for some reform and some change. And that's a very positive thing to take forward from here, because I would like to see old school politics end as well.
Cal Pratt, he's with the Free State Project. He and his wife moved to New Hampshire as part of a project to give libertarians a stronger voice in politics there. Cal, thanks so much for speaking with us, and we'll see together what happens.
Okay, thank you, Robin.
And when we come back, Disney waves its marketing wand, turns grown women into princess brides. That's in 1 minute, here and now. This holiday season, Disney struck gold again with Enchanted. The film brought in more than $120 million worldwide. It's the story of a princess played by Amy Adams who is magically cast out of her animated fairy tale land and pops out of a manhole on the mean streets of New York City.
And then I climbed out of this big round hole and I got very lost. But not to worry. I'm certain that Edward is already searching for me. No doubt by morning he'll come and rescue me from this strange land. Take me home and the two of us can share in true love's kiss.
The film is an extension of Disney's $4 billion princess brand. It originally targeted little girls with princess dolls, dress-up gowns, and games. Now it's focusing on adult women with princess weddings. 29-year-old Lindsay Timmerman of Wilmington, Delaware, is planning one of them. It's the wedding of her dreams with red roses, a golden gown, and hopefully some glass slippers. She joins us on the line. And Lindsay, I know you've been to Disney World dozens of times. Your folks now live in Orlando, so obviously you're a fan. But what is the appeal of being a princess on your wedding day?
It was one of those, I'm just going to go look. I thought it'd be kind of fun, just wanted to see what they were like, and just you put on the dress, and it was just like, it was just a lot of fun. It just overtook it. It was like, oh, this is how I'm supposed to feel when I get married.
It's a fantasy.
Yeah, you know, it's a fun day. It's a, you know, one day you're supposed to just have the best time of your life, so I thought, why not?
Well, now you try it on the line of dresses that Disney makes that are patterned after these princesses. Tell us the one you picked.
The one I picked, it's actually after Belle. It's similar, actually, kind of to the ballroom scene in the Beauty and the Beast animated film, and it's just a gorgeous gold, light gold color, and just it's something different and just something a lot of fun. It's really pretty.
Well, now, there are other dresses where there was a Snow White dress that's being offered. Do you worry that you might look like you're at a Halloween party or a wedding?
They made them absolutely so wedding-like. They don't look like Cinderella's costume, you know, walking down Main Street. They look like wedding dresses and, you know, make you just feel absolutely gorgeous, which is fun, but not too princessy.
Well, we're going to have we'll link to the pictures online so people can see them, but they cost over $1,000, so they're certainly not costumes. And just tell us some of the other quick details that you're going to have at your wedding.
Well, we were, you know, thinking of flowers, and then it just made sense to do the red roses that, like, Belle has, or they have under the glass in Beauty and the Beast.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing actually the wedding in Disney and then a big party at home, so we're kind of doing double the celebration. But we're going to, you know, I am going to do possibly the glass slipper, still working on the horse-drawn carriage. Just going to make it a wonderful day.
You'll be there at the Castle of Disney World. We understand your fiancé, Mark, is going along with this, but drew the line at dressing like the Beast.
We tease him. Of course, every one of his friends just are having a field day with that. You know, I'm the beauty, he's the beast. You gotta love it. But yes, he will just be wearing a suit.
Well, what are your friends saying about this?
You know, because my friends, you know, they know me so well. One of my best friends was the one that actually told me about the dresses, and I Googled it and looked online for them and found the trunk show that they were having to showcase them. And knowing me and knowing how much fun I have at Disney and how much we just love Disney and my family, it just seems to make sense, they said. It'll just add to the day, I think.
And maybe happily ever after.
That's what I'm going for. For sure.
Lindsay Timmerman, future princess bride, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, Newsweek magazine recently wrote about princess power, and associate editor Ramin Satuda joins us with more. And Ramin, first of all, can you describe the business that Disney in particular has set up?
Yes, well, you know, it's a pretty big kingdom in Disney speak. What happened was Andy Mooney, the chairman of consumer goods, went to a Disney on Ice show and saw all the different girls sort of dressed up in princess uniforms. And so he decided to combine all the princesses together. You take Belle and Sleeping Beauty and Ariel from The Little Mermaid and Snow White and Cinderella, and you make them one group, and they're more powerful than the Spice Girls. Everyone wants to be a princess. It started out with products for girls. It started out with stuff to put in your bedroom to be a princess, to have sort of princess carpets and princess sheets and princess bed covers. And then from there, you sort of take the brand and you extend it, and you think, well, if girls want to be a princess, then girls who grow up still remember that. They still have the nostalgia for the whole princess fairy tale phenomenon. And now they're targeting older women with princess wedding dresses and a whole bridal line that includes princess gowns, princess shoes, princess tiaras, of course, at your wedding.
Well, and apparently you can buy the dresses with your new Ariel Visa credit card. Ariel has been licensed to Visa, and so now women can use the credit card to buy a lot of these products that are being targeted at them. How has Disney, and not just Disney, but others who are jumping on the princess bandwagon, how have they sort of changed what it means to be a princess, given that they're targeting these older women who might be working women?
Well, the sense of the princess has changed because if you look at real-life princesses, Princess Diana, for example, they don't often live happily ever after. But the princess myth, targeted to women, sort of suggests that there's one person out there that's right for you. And this goes beyond Disney. If you look, and I did some research into sort of the way in which online dating sites target their consumers, the language in the advertising campaigns, they often say, find your prince charming. They're clearly grown up in the sort of prince culture, and it's somewhere in their subconscious, they remember the Disney films, and Disney's responsible for princesses. I mean, if it weren't for Disney, I don't think people would think of princesses in the same way, and meeting your prince charming, and living happily ever after with your fairy godmother and bibbidi-bobbidi-boo. So it just sort of, it's changed the way in which we conceptualize love. It's not just a marketing ploy, even though it is that too, but I think it's a huge part of the way in which we think about love and finding the right person.
Well, we understand that the fact that there are these older women now, though, who are part of the new princess market, that Disney and others have had to sort of change that concept because they may be looking for their prince, but they're not going to sit around and wait for him.
That's true. You know, if you look at the princesses now, they're more empowered, they're stronger. And now that when you look at it, Ariel in the late 80s was more powerful, but then now that Ariel's on Broadway, she's even stronger. She defeats the Sea Witch in the Broadway version of The Little Mermaid. She talks about wanting to go to land, not just because of a man, but because it provides her with more opportunity. The Sea Witch herself in this Broadway show is more empowered, and sort of we understand why she's evil, and it's all about girl power. So we understand these characters more. In the new movie Enchanted, again, the princess defeats the evil stepmother on her own. So yes, they are definitely sort of trying to be more contemporary by making these women less like someday my prince will come and maybe more like I'm going to go find my prince myself and I'm going to slay the evil dragon myself because I am living in the era where we can elect a woman president.
While using my credit card to buy new sheets.
Yes, while doing that as well.
Ramin Sathuda, by the way, companies have also realized that they've got to be more diverse. There's going to be another first, the first African-American princess.
There is. Disney is releasing its first animated movie with an African-American princess in 2009, which is kind of shocking if you think about it, because there's been a Native American princess, Pocahontas, and there's been an Arab princess, Jasmine, from Aladdin, and we even had an Asian princess, Mulan. So Disney has a lot of pressure on its shoulders because everyone wants a legitimate, strong princess. They're hoping that this princess is something that will live on for generations.
Ramin Sathuda, associate editor of Newsweek magazine, speaking about the $4 billion princess brand from Disney. Ramin, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.